another somebody done somebody wrong song, and make me feel at home while I miss my baby.
Okay, so I am here with Catherine Schultz, who is most recently the author of Being Wrong. Catherine, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing quite well, and in fact, I just want to clarify, I am likely to be wrong at some point during the course of this conversation.
Well, that makes two of us.
Yeah. I wanted to first of all start off with Thomas Kuhn, who you bring up with a few times. You note his observation, the breakdown of one belief system and the dawning of another is always characterized by an explosion of competing hypotheses. But he also argued that it was impossible to conduct science in the absence of a pre-existing theory. This brings to mind the F. Scott Fitzgerald maxim that the sign of a first-rate intellectual is to be able to hold two opposing notions in the brain at the same time. How can the two opposing viewpoint be reconciled with the Kuhnian viewpoint? Do you have any thoughts on this? Or is it really a matter of cognitive dissonance taking care of this problem? Or
I don't know that those two things are at odds with each other. I suspect that Thomas Kuhn would have been very much in favor of Fitzgerald's notion that really sophisticated thinking involves the capacity to hold a belief while also being willing to entertain its antithesis or entertaining evidence that potentially undermines it. And of course, that's what practicing scientists, at least in theory, do all the time. Now, in practice, is everyone always out there in their labs questioning their own theories? Probably not, but it is a part of the ethos of science in general. And, you know, I think there's a political scientist I quite like named Philip Tetlock, who I cite in the book, who describes this kind of thinking as self-subversive thinking, which is a phrase I really love. It's this notion that you can believe something and simultaneously have this undercurrent in your brain that's saying, well, what if it's not true in this situation? Or what if this part of it's right, but that part of it's wrong? Or what if the whole thing falls apart? And to me, that is the sign. Fitzgerald got it right. That is the sign of sophisticated thinking. And yeah. Unless I'm missing something, I think Kuhn would have supported that.
Yeah. Well, he believed in this kind of halfway house of having competing hypotheses or even having just some middle ground in this, some transitional middle ground. That's why I asked the question of whether that middle ground is really reflective of the same Fitzgeraldian viewpoint.
Right. I think one distinction is whether you're talking about an individual person or a system. And I think what Kuhn was getting at was that when you have a scientific paradigm collapse, like let's say that we think that the sun revolves around the earth and suddenly there's a lot of challenges to that and we start seeing some counter evidence, then there's this kind of sort of exciting but also sort of panicky era where everybody is generating new theories to account for this evidence that doesn't seem to make sense under the old theory. And so you have a whole system that's in crisis and that's generating new theories. And then you're exactly right. You shift. Eventually it settles down and you arrive at one new, very established theory. And I do think that's how systems work, whether it's science or, you know, for that matter, actually book publishing. I think book publishing is in the middle of a Kuhnian paradigm crisis right now, where we have an old model, we don't know what the new model is, and in the meantime, there's a million competing hypotheses. But within any given individual, I still think you can hold a belief, and if you are a sophisticated thinker, undermine it, question it, and challenge it in all kinds of ways.
Sure. I want to actually shift tacks and bring up the case of Penny Bernstein, who you bring up in the book. She was absolutely insistent that Stephen Avery had raped and assaulted her. DNA testing demonstrated that Avery was innocent. Then Avery got out of jail, proceeded to murder Teresa Halbach in 2005, the first and only time in the history of the Innocence Project that an exoneree had gone on to commit a violent crime. Penny, though, which is a very interesting case, despite the assault, the misidentification, the murder trifecta, she was able to accept the objective evidence of Avery being innocent in relation to her, but guilty in relation to this other woman. What do you think factors into account for that fixed belief of being able to look upon the scenario with some objective quality? Is it a matter of having gone through the act of denial? Do you have any particular speculation? Or does it go back to this this Kuhnian idea that once she had gone through the bridge, she was able to reconcile the truth, so to speak, or, you know, she was not wrong?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, first, I will say that having spent quite a lot of time with Penny Bernstein to get this story out of her and, you know, hear all the details, she impressed me as someone who is exceptionally, exceptionally thoughtful about wrongness, and in that respect could and probably should be a role model for all of us. And then I think the underlying question is, and the one I assume you're getting at, is, well, why? What is it that makes her so able to be responsive in the face of shifting evidence? Because it's very, very hard to do, especially in a situation where the stakes are so high, so emotional, so personal. And I asked her that question straight up. You know, how is it that when so many people around you were unable to face this evidence, and for that matter, when so many people around you are unable to face very trivial instances of coping with wrongness, you know, what do you think it is about you that made you able to do this? And, you know, she was, it was obviously something she'd thought about a lot and didn't have a completely clear answer, in part because these are very, you know, personalities are so complicated, and at bottom what's going on is it has something to do with her personality. But one thing that she said that was very interesting was she had spent many years between her assault and Stephen Avery's exoneration working in the prison system. She essentially decided to take the experience of this horrible experience that had happened to her and try to heal herself and other people by working with violent criminals and trying to help them understand the impact of their crimes on their victims and on the communities, and really work within a rehabilitation model of criminal justice. So she spent years and years and years talking to people about facing up to being wrong. And I think that she ultimately felt like her turn came.
Yeah.
And she could not fail to practice what she had preached. And I think she's someone who's deeply humble and deeply thoughtful, and for whatever reason was able to kind of rise above it and look at the situation plainly in ways that actually do, I think, kind of put most of the rest of us to shame.
Well, essentially, it's contradictory reactions undergoing the John Ross optical mirage idea that you bring early in the book. But I'm curious if it's more of an experiential form of being wrong, or more of this, I suppose, this holding contradictory opinions you were talking about with the Thomas Kuhnian thing earlier. I mean, if someone like Bernstein can live with these contradictory realities, I'm wondering to what degree do you think humanity as a whole can? Why is there such a problem with this wrongness, or this this lack of knowledge, or mm-hmm. this inability to parse knowledge because of belief?
I think you've completely hit on the heart of the question of if and how we can deal with wrongness, and I do think it comes down to our capacity to deal with really complex and contradictory realities. And I do think that in an ideal world, it's something we would all be able to do, but I think that for the most part, what it takes to do that is honestly a real capacity to tolerate emotion, including some negative emotions. And I talk to a lot of therapists and psychologists about this question to try to understand, well, what makes a person able to face up to wrongness? And I do think sort of the most insightful and pithy responses were, can you deal with being sad and scared? Because there are, you know, the thing about contradictory realities is it means the world is not simple. It means we aren't completely in control of it. It means you don't know what happens next. And those, on a sort of existential level, those are very hard realities to face up to. And I think that the capacity to do so does, to some extent, depend on whether you're the kind of person who is excited about the notion that we don't know it all, or totally freaked out by that notion.
Well, you write in this book, if the ability to admit that we are wrong depends on the ability to tolerate emotion, it is because being wrong, like grieving or falling in love, is fundamentally an emotional experience. But what if Rollo May's idea of being both fully committed to the possibility of contradiction while being simultaneously aware that we might be wrong? I mean, in the blow of being wrong, I'm wondering if that blow of being wrong is emotionally softened or nullified by that cognitive snap.
You mean by the awareness that we might be?
Yeah, exactly. By rational cogitation upon the issue.
Well, you know, there's a very good case study in this, and it's me, right? I mean,
I knew you were the answer here.
Well, only insofar as I just spent 5 years thinking about being wrong, and so the logical question is, well, am I better at dealing with it or not? And on the one hand, I think the answer is both yes, absolutely, and also no, not as much better as I wished that I were. Certainly, I think that coming to think about wrongness in some of the ways I describe in the book as inevitable, as useful, as potentially pleasurable is very, very helpful in changing your relationship to being wrong. I think that learning, realizing that the act of saying I was wrong is often a much more gratifying and easier one than the act of insisting that you're right, which is very counter to our normal intuitions. All those things I think can really help, but that actual blow of being wrong that you're talking about, that moment of being invested in a belief and having it vanish out from under you, whether it's fairly trivial or more substantive, I think that moment is tough. You know, I do think that we tend to experience a sense of sting around it and a little loss of ego or a little frustration or whatever. And I also think that's okay. I mean, I don't think what we should be trying to do is eradicate that moment. I think we should be moving past it more quickly and getting more comfortable with it.
But see, that assumes that the person who is having that emotional response has an ego with which to sort of say, oh my God, I've been wrong. What if they've prefigured the possibility of doubt into their belief? There do you, I guess, get a more rational approach to the state of being wrong or right or whatnot?
Well, I doubt that. I mean, you know, maybe Descartes is an exception. I mean, I'm sure there's an exception somewhere, but I doubt that doubt can ever be so prophylactic against the exigencies of the ego. We all have relatively forceful egos.
Do we?
You know, it's interesting. One thing that in the course of working on this book, a certain number of people would say to me, well, you know, but I'm like plagued by doubt all the time.
Yeah.
And I think that's really valid and really true, right? There's no question that, and in fact, an interesting thing about us is that we can be incredibly committed to and passionate about certain beliefs, you know, our political beliefs or, you know, the Red Sox or whatever, and completely at a loss about other things. You know, did I just yell at my kid when I shouldn't have yelled at my kid? I mean, stuff that can keep us up at night. So I think doubt is real, but I certainly also think that most of us, just as a sort of basic pragmatic matter of getting through life, assume that we're right a lot and struggle when that turns out not to be the case. And I don't, to answer your initial question, you know, so much of the time it comes down to what we're wrong about. I think that doubt and a kind of constant awareness of the possibility of error is in fact very, very protective against the sting of wrongness when we're able to maintain it. Most of us can't maintain that kind of doubt all the time, and all of us have some beliefs that we pretty much never doubt. So we aren't 100% protected against that experience ever.
But let's go back to this idea of doubt as an emotional experience. I mean, some people might be wrong. I'm wrong very often, and I actually find some great delight in being wrong. It's actually greatly liberating at times to realize that you're completely... I mean, there is no head-slapping moment sometimes. It's more of like, oh, well, this is very delightful. I know nothing about the universe. This is of a great comfort. So that doesn't necessarily have to be a rational response. Or maybe the emotional response is in relation to, I suppose, this cognitive alignment of what is right and what is wrong and the like. Or perhaps recognition that what our existence to knowledge is really in relation to belief, and knowing that our belief is fungible, it's going to be ever shifting and the like. I mean, therefore, I'm wondering if it really is an emotional reaction, or even if it is related to ego, or whether ego comes in the response to the news that you're wrong, or there is no ego. I don't know. It's an individual basis, I suppose.
Yeah, I think it depends both very much on the individual person and on the individual belief. But I do want to say this point you're bringing up about pleasure, I think, is supremely important. I think that we underestimate to a radical degree how pleasurable it can be to be wrong. And, you know, as someone who, you know, just described herself as sometimes, you know, frustrated by and, you know, hurt by the experience of being wrong, I think we've all had that experience. But part of why I wrote this book is that I'm also very committed to this other experience of error, which is the one that... where you're surprised in the best possible way and you are delighted and the world suddenly appears totally new to you and it's exciting and it's invigorating. And that to me is in a sense almost kind of the baseline impulse behind the book, is almost a resuscitation or a rehabilitation of error as a really joyful experience.
I'm wondering if being wrong has a lot to do with severity. I mean, to get back to cognitive dissonance, an early version of Leon Festinger's cognitive dissonance theory, as you point out with Marion Keech, appeared in When Prophecy Falls, and that was related to UFO doomsday cults. So the beliefs were found to be false. The believers saw an uptake in their belief despite the fact that they were false. And you also bring up William Miller's 19th century end of the world prophecies as an example of this phenomenon. But what of Daryl Burns' self-perception theory, which you don't bring up in the book, in which people develop attitudes or beliefs by observing their internal behavior, concluding how attitudes come before behaviors, kind of similar to what I was talking about in the last question. Surely a belief, for example, that the Mets will make it to the series or whatnot, that's not something that, if you're wrong about that, then you're going to lose sleep at night. I mean, that's a very fungible belief.
Right, absolutely. It's funny that you bring up the Mets as an example, because I just had the fun experience of interviewing a sports writer, this guy named Joe Posnanski, who works for Sports Illustrated, about his relationship to wrongness. And it's great to talk to sports writers, because they deal with wrongness all the time, and it's almost always trivial. And so they really have an appreciation of the kind of more fun and lighthearted element behind it, and of wrongness as part of the narrative of life and part of what builds suspense and punctures suspense and makes for good stories. And, you know, I think that that's absolutely right. There's no question that we can be wrong about a huge range of things, and that, you know, almost everything about our response is going to be determined by what we were wrong about. Some of it is going to be determined by who we are, but a lot of it is going to be determined by, well, what was the belief in question?
Yeah.
And to me, that was part of what was fun about working on this topic, is the range of things that we can err about is essentially infinite, so there's a lot of room to play around there.
But going back to self-perception theory, I mean, you had alluded to it through another mechanism in an earlier answer, but I'm curious what your thoughts are in terms of cognitive dissonance existing either in relation or as an alternative to self-perception theory. Did you do much investigation along those lines and make its way into an earlier draft of the book? I mean,
I'm not sure exactly. Reframe for me the question
Burns,
you're trying to get at.
Well, we're talking about Walter Burns' self-perception theory. This was presented as an alternative to cognitive dissonance, in which basically prefigured beliefs or prefigured conclusions about attitudes defected behavior, as opposed to cognitive dissonance, which, you know, multiple notions causing a burnout.
Mm-hmm. Again, I'm not sure that those would be antithetical. I certainly think that the way that we perceive our own identity and the kinds of beliefs on which we establish our own identity are, first of all, as susceptible to failure and error as anything else, and some of the most shocking things to have fall apart from under us. But it doesn't seem to me that any of that would be at odds with stumbling into a situation of cognitive dissonance where we hold one belief, it's contradicted by the evidence, and then we somehow need to move to resolve that contradiction. And cognitive dissonance theory doesn't state that we're necessarily going to resolve it by, you know, continuing to deny the evidence. It simply suggests that dissonance needs to be resolved, that it's very, very uncomfortable. And one of the, as Festinger famously found, one of the possible mechanisms of resolution is to actually increase your faith in the belief, even in the face of just, like, absolute, you know, flat disconfirmation of your theory. But I don't see those two kind of ways of making sense of human identity and behavior particularly at odds with each other.
Well, one involves being in outright denial about the reality that's in front of you, and the other one involves prefiguring that in some way. That's why I suggest if there's a discrepancy here.
Prefiguring it in what sense?
Prefiguring it in the sense that you know your attitudes, you know how you're going to respond to a particular reality stimulus in front of you, and therefore you're going to be more flexible in the way that you react to it, or more aware, possibly. That was the argument against cognitive dissonance by Burns. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I think, I mean, to my knowledge, cognitive dissonance theory has held up pretty well over the years since Festinger has first proposed it. It's certainly not the only model to make sense of how we, respond to dissonant information. And maybe part of what you're getting at is that, you know, there are other models of kind of identity and attitude in which we are less likely to set ourselves up for cognitive dissonance because we're more continuously adjusting for the evidence.
Yeah.
There's kind of a fine-grain reevaluation of ourselves and our belief systems in an ongoing way. And I do think that when we are able to be flexible in that moment-to-moment way, we don't set ourselves up for the same kind of catastrophic belief systems failures, because, you know, in the same way that when you drive on the highway, you make constant adjustments all the time, you know, versus if you're, like, kind of a train that's locked into a course and going 80 miles an hour, you don't have the option of slowing down or shifting gears. If an obstacle comes up, you're just going to hit the obstacle.
Got it. This actually gets close to it. I also wanted to talk about depression. Near the end of the book, you suggest that depressed people, not sharing the illusion that they can control the course of their lives, don't possess the conviction that they are above average in virtually every respect. But this assumes that those who are not depressed maintain this conviction. So what of that? Why corral depressed people into this category? I mean, happy people might also have a similar rational conviction.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of evidence to suggest, and by a lot I mean like a lot, it's a highly, highly replicated studies. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that depressed people generally experience what's known as depressive realism, meaning that they have a view of reality that is very much stripped of illusions. They don't entertain any sense that they are unusually important. They don't entertain any sense that their contributions are lasting. They don't think they're happier or smarter or better off than many other people in the world. And in a sort of strict existential sense, they're right. You know, like, they understand I'm going to die. Life is short. The scope of the universe is long. How much difference do I make? Well, you know, probably not that much of a difference. And it's highly, highly correlated with depression. And I say correlated because it's not precisely clear whether those attitudes are cause or effect. You know, we don't know if that constellation of attitudes tends to produce depression or if being depressed tends to produce that constellation of attitudes. Now, for those of us who are fortunate enough to not be experiencing depression, or at least not currently experiencing depression, we might share those beliefs in the abstract. I absolutely understand that in the whole sweep of cosmic eternity, my life is a blip. It's meaningless. I understand that 99.99999% of the world has never heard of me, will never care. I make really no damn difference in the whole scheme of things.
You made a difference to me, I would say.
Well, thank you. And likewise, you know, we're here. And then in some ways, that's exactly the difference between being depressive and not depressive, right? Is you and I are here, we're enjoying a conversation together, and we can set aside that reality. There's listeners, hopefully, out there somewhere. And we're capable of setting aside the sort of existential bleakness and living our lives. And in that sense, we are nurturing an illusion, and we're letting ourselves live under that illusion, and it's really healthy. I mean, that, and I bring this up in the book by way of saying that there are some kinds of wrongness that are crucial to our survival. You know, the capacity to maintain the illusion that life is meaningful and worthwhile is the difference between being depressed and not depressed. And you can argue or not about whether it's an illusion, but we do know that people who don't maintain that and have this kind of colder, harsher view of reality can really suffer emotionally from it.
I'm glad you brought up illusion, because I wanted to talk about Plato's The Republic, his conviction that an ideal civilization would banish all artists because they are in the business of distorting the truth, which would be this illusion we're talking about, that art is worse than useless because it misleads us into suggesting this representation is reality. You suggest later that art temporarily frees us from our isolation by permitting our head to momentarily marinate in this kind of distortion and wrongness. Is art merely a mechanism with which to avoid a more absolute declaration of wrongness or depression? I mean, maybe continue on with this line here.
Is art really a mechanism to, how did you phrase it?
Well, to avoid an absolute declaration of wrongness, that depressing scenario you outlined just now.
I think the depression is about absolute rightness, right? The depression is a vision of the world that is absolutely stripped of illusion, and art is a vision of the world that in some sense is all about illusion, or at the very least, and this to me is what is so appealing and so important about it, it's the expression of a completely individual identity. It's your mind interacting with the world in a way that is completely unique and specific and unreplicable by anyone else. And in that sense, it's quite similar to error, right? I mean, the fascinating thing about wrongness is that typically in a lot of situations, you know, there is one way to be right. There's one objective reality out there that we might or might not ever have access to. And then there's, you know, 6.2 billion ways to be wrong, or however many humans there are on the planet. And that wrongness is your mind's projection of the universe with all of the sort of strange, unique, kind of quirky vision of it that you yourself hold. And in that sense, I do think it's very closely related to wrongness. And so did Plato, as you're pointing out. His gripe with artists was that they were presenting a distorted vision of reality for no reason. And he very explicitly says, you know, this is false representation. This is error. It does not belong in an ideal society. And I don't have any disagreement with the first part of that. I actually agree with him that art, in a sense, is a form of error. My disagreement with him, and I think this is the discomfort, as I say in the book, this is the discomfort that a lot of, like, 19-year-old philosophy students feel when they first read this passage, and they get very disgruntled, and they hate Plato, and they hate philosophy, is the equation of error with something so terrible that you would want to banish it from society. Yeah. Plato makes the, you know, step one is art is a form of error, which I agree with, but then he makes this jump to step two, which is, and therefore it should be banished. It's a poison unto society. I don't agree with that. I think it is kind of the heart and lifeblood of society.
But let's venture further here. I mean, you're saying that to be a happy member of our present society, you must embrace art, you must embrace illusion, you must embrace meaninglessness. this is the idea of being wrong. This is the idea of embracing wrong. I mean, I would disagree with you. One might actually embrace an illusion and nevertheless be relatively sanguine in temperament. I mean, you could, what I would call myself as an optimistic realist, I could recognize an illusion before me. I could recognize artifice before me, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the artifice isn't fun or it isn't meaningful in its own way. I mean, meaning to what of that particular predicament?
Oh, no, why, I think we're actually saying the same thing. Yeah. I definitely don't think that embracing art or embracing error is in any way a kind of pessimistic or negative image of the world. Quite the opposite. I think the desire to eradicate error and the inability to entertain illusion is the pessimistic stance and the one that is depressive in a sense, yeah. And that doesn't allow for illusion and error at all. My own position is that that embrace of wrongness is the kind of healthy, flexible, cheery, optimistic one. You know, I don't think that it calls on us at all to accept meaninglessness. I think it calls on us to accept a certain measure of lack of control. I think the experience of being wrong is very deeply one of suddenly losing control. You have a belief system, you're standing on top of it, it's nice solid ground, and like, oops, it's gone out from under you. And that is an experience of being out of control, but that's nothing at all like an experience of meaninglessness. In fact, it's an opportunity to recreate meaning, which is very exciting, yeah. And
or
create new meaning.
Or recreate a belief system on the fly, too.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And make new meaning, which is what, to me, is so exciting. It's this constant reinvention of ideas and belief and meaning.
Well, the question is whether it's actually risky to constantly reinvent a belief system on a daily basis, which perhaps an abundant optimist might actually do. Right, you know, confronted with one lie, you're creating an additional artifice. I mean, is that even healthy to as for a human being to be if they're optimistic?
Well, I don't think any of us constantly recreate our belief systems, and for very good reason, right? As I say in the book, and as you alluded to earlier, to get through life in a very basic day-to-day way, you need some solid ground underneath you, or at least you need to be able to pretend that there's some solid ground underneath you, and that requires not inspecting every single one of your beliefs every time you know, take a step or sit at a table or open the door. You're not going to sit there and think, is that door handle really a door handle? You're just going to go open it and walk through the door. And that's really important, and it extends well beyond those sort of basic physical beliefs. We all believe that our friends who are who they've always appeared to be. We believe that our family functions more or less the way we think our family functions. And I don't think it's either healthy or necessary to recreate that all the time. I think that it is healthy and helpful to be able to be enough engaged with the possibility of change and of error that when it comes along and hits you upside the head, because it will, you have some resources to cope with it.
Yeah. Or if life is what happens when you make other plans, maybe you shouldn't have such a rigid belief system. Maybe you need to have a pockmarked belief system that is almost illusory to some degree, in which case, where is the mental health here? Mm-hmm. Or is there in fact a very strong mental health in not being aware of your belief system and therefore embracing wrongness?
There is actually, I mean, there's empirical data on this, interestingly. There is, I think there is a kind of mental health sweet spot, so to speak, and it seems to be the one in which your huge gestalt beliefs about the world are a little wrong and you're really committed to them. And this is where we come back to depressive realism. If you are able to generally believe that life is good, life is worthwhile, even at its hard moments, there's meaning in the world and there's purpose and there's a reason for you to be there, whether or not that belief is accurate, that illusion about the world is going to preserve your mental health. It's going to make you a much happier person. And if it functions in combination with the ability to be aware of and skeptical about your sort of more small bore beliefs, that is the optimal mental health. And interestingly, psychologists have found over and over that those two things go together. That the more kind of, to borrow your word, sanguine and insouciant you are about the big picture of life, the more you feel yourself to be a secure, happy, worthwhile person, the more you are able to entertain challenges to the kind of mid-level belief systems, your politics, your religion, your whatever it may be. And that appears to be the, you know, at least, well, I mean, I'm very skeptical of any kind of sweeping statement about how to be a happy person or whatever, but that appears to be very crucial to mental health and also, not surprisingly, to the capacity to cope with error when it comes along.
On the other hand, let's bring up Whitaker Chambers. You bring Chambers up in the book. The idea of going from this tremendous shift from communism to basically ratting out his friend, Alger Hiss. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, you know, he insisted that he had a return to his identity. It's an example of a prevalent Jungian notion of like the conscious and the subconscious constantly being at odds against each other. But if the idea of being wrong is perhaps, maybe it's more fixed than we think it is. What do you think? What are your thoughts on this?
More fixed in what sense?
More fixed in the sense that that our identity is more fixed with this idea of, hey, we believe one thing, and if we're vocal about it, we actually may believe the obverse. Is that suggestion you bring up in the book around that, in that particular chapter. Mm-hmm. You know, how do we tie this in with the fixed notion of identity, the fixed notion of embracing wrongness?
Mm-hmm. Well, the Jungian theory is really interesting. I mean, just to quickly recap, essentially, and this is a very, very boiled down version of it. Sorry, that was a dramatic sound effect in the background for a moment.
Yeah.
The very sort of bare bones version of Jung's take on this was that the more stridently you hold a belief, the more you are certainly holding it in the face of and defending it against your own internal doubts about it, such that at some point those internal doubts are going to get the better hand, they are going to surge up out of your subconscious, and you're going to experience this absolute polar reversal in how you think about things. And that's exactly what happened to Whittaker Chambers. I mean, he went like absolutely 180 degrees from being the most impassioned, committed communist you can imagine to this, you know, obviously such a committed anti-communist that he went on, as you said, to rat out his friend and so on and so forth and declare it to be the worst evil ever visited on the earth. What's interesting to me about the Jungian theory is that it implies that stridency is unstable, that if we hold a belief stridently, that position, it's like being at the very tip-top point of a teeter-totter, and it's gonna fall. Whereas if you are able, even if you hold a belief with tremendous conviction, if you are able to hold it while also entertaining doubts about it, as you
cited the Fitzgerald thing, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, or the Rollo May thing, where, you know, you can hold a belief and at the same time, you know, without any dampening of your conviction, question it. That is a far more stable position. It doesn't suggest, at least in that Jungian paradigm, that it's just going to reverse itself because all of these subconscious doubts are going to roar up and take you over.
Yeah, but I'm also wondering if it's a largely introspective variation on Nagel's What's It Like to Be a Bat to some degree. Was that a viable leap that one might make from there?
I'm trying to follow you from Jung to Nagel. I mean, these are certainly both. Jung to me is thinking about how our own identities work and how our own belief systems work, and Nagel is wondering about how we think about other people.
Yeah.
The essay in question, What Is It Like to Be a Bat, is this sort of wonderful meditation on the inability to know the interiority of other beings. Now, Nagel was very careful about not making the claim that we can't know other people. Obviously, we have quite a lot of resources to know other people, and we know one another very well. And he was specifically talking about bats for a reason somewhat unrelated to this conversation. But the point stands that up above, like beyond a certain point, we are somewhat inscrutable to one another. So, and I suppose, you know, one connection we could draw is that Jung's point, in a sense, is that we're inscrutable even unto ourselves, that especially when we are so strident as to drown out our own internal doubts, we are leaving out a lot of self-knowledge we could otherwise benefit from.
But there would seem to me to be some relationship between the idea of returning to your identity per Chambers versus knowing the interiority of another person via Nagel. And I'm curious if there might be some, because we're talking about perception, essentially, self-perception, and how one perceives other human beings is largely based off out of the self.
Sure, I think that's true to some extent, that of course our own, our ideas about ourself and more generally about selfhood really inform how we make sense of other people, no question about that. And I think that to the extent that we're able to accept inscrutability and unknowability in ourselves, we're in some ways going to be much more empathetic, I think, to people around us. In terms of the, I mean, in some ways I think the most interesting question about Jung is this point you bring up, that this very strange notion that when we've changed really radically, we've somehow returned to ourselves. And that's what's so fascinating to me about that Whittaker Chambers story, that he very explicitly describes, I mean, he's had the most radical change in view you can imagine a human being undergoing. And he describes it as if it has somehow been his natural viewpoint all along, that it's just, it's like, come home, you know? And we hear this narrative in other contexts. We hear it especially in religious contexts. There's a real notion that the convert, someone who's been an atheist their entire life or been a member of some other religion, has somehow come home when they've found this what to an outsider looks like a brand new and completely antithetical identity.
The Eldridge Cleaver principle, yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And it's really fascinating. I mean, I think that it speaks to our, and it is about, it returns to that issue of control in some ways, because it speaks to our need, I think, to feel like on some level we're stable individuals and our identities are stable, even when all of the external evidence suggests that we've changed really radically. We like to see it as somehow this deep-seated essence of ourself that remains unchanging.
Well, to take the Nagel horse and the Jungian horse, I want to actually jump to Hamlet, which, yes, the theory of everything. I wanted to point out, you know, you point out in the book that the perception of Hamlet as this guy who is crippled with indecision was not so much the case for the first 150 years of Hamlet's reception. He was considered to be vigorous, bold, heroic. And this suggests that the perception of human folly, whether decisive or indecisive, is subject to societal change. That's why I'm trying to sort of see if I could tie that in with Jung and Nagel here, because you may perceive Hamlet to be decisive or indecisive or even somewhere in between, but if that doesn't mesh with the general consensus, you're going to have a serious problem with whether or not you're wrong or you're right, or your ability to see a return to your own identity, or your ability to see a return to Hamlet's true identity over the course of 150 years, or your ability to perceive the interiority of Hamlet, who is illusory, or another human being who is not.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's, I think I'm going to run with the Hamlet theme for a moment, because partly just because I love it. I mean, here, you know, welcome to my geeky self.
No problem.
But, you know, I would love to find some scholar of British history and literature who can help us understand what it was that was going on in England at the moment when the public perception of Hamlet suddenly shifted from being, as you say, this bold, vigorous, you know, manly prince to this notion that we have today where he's this kind of like, he's a sort of pussyfooting, indecisive. You're right, exactly. Yeah, you know, and he sort of can't make up his mind about anything, and it's a fatal flaw. This quality of indecision suddenly becomes his most pronounced element. And it is sort of I just sort of barely touch on it in the book, but it is kind of it's a fascinating historical question. Why suddenly did culture, and especially political culture, look at a prince who was stuck in a very hard situation, and instead of saying, as you might reasonably say, wow, tough situation, you know, your dad's dead, this ghost of your dad has come along and told you that he was killed by his brother. Wait, did I just get that right? Hamlet's uncle.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
And you're supposed to go avenge that death. Now, if this were you or me, we would find ourselves in a bind. Like, are you really going to accept the evidence of a ghost in order to go commit murder that is also patricide and also regicide? I mean, that's a, you know, fairly weighty decision to make. And yet, for some reason, we look at that and we don't see all the complexity around him, and we don't see the stakes of that decision, of the decision he makes, and we don't see how fraught and difficult and complicated that situation is. We see someone who can't make up his mind and take a strong decision and take action on the basis of that decision. And that, to me, bespeaks a real anxiety about authority and a real anxiety about the capacity of our political leaders to be decisive and forceful, even when circumstances are so fraught and puzzling and confusing and difficult that decisive action might not be the right answer. It might be dangerous.
Yeah.
And yet we crave it desperately.
Yeah. And I think one historical example recently is the demotion of Pluto from planet to mere hunk in the solar system. Suddenly we all grew up with this notion of Pluto as this fixed planet. And it's difficult to shake that particular concept now that it's been officially, no, it's not a planet. You know, that may also represent this idea of cognitive dissonance, or this idea, this dilemma with authority. I mean, do you have any ideas on how human beings can shift to this, or is this going to be something that's going to plague them throughout the entire duration of the human race?
Well, I think probably both. I think that we can expect that there's always going to be people who are going to really struggle with wrongness. And part of that's a struggle with change. You know, I think in that sense, the Pluto example is a great one because, right, we all grew up with, you know, like my very educated mother just baked us 9 pizza pie, whatever it was. And Pluto to us is a fixed element of our solar system and it's a planet. And there are a lot of people in the world who are just really resistant to change. They don't like change of any sort, and it's threatening, and it's scary, and it's not the way things used to be, and it's not the way they learned it. And the thing about wrongness is that it almost always, in fact, probably actually always, involves change. It involves a change of belief. It involves a change in your perspective. And if you are fundamentally uncomfortable with change, even when it's about something quite trivial, like do we call Pluto a planet or do we call it something else, you're going to have a lot of difficulty with error. And for that reason, I think we can safely assume that there's always going to be people who really struggle with it. That said, I think that different cultures and different societies handle the idea of wrongness differently, and I do believe that cultural change is possible, and I do believe, and the book was written very much out of this faith, that I think that the capacity to think about things, to suddenly have words and language and categories for things is really, really helpful. You know, until we have a category that's called, you know, hipsters. We don't have hipsters, you know, just to take a totally trivial
example. Unless, of course, you deny that category altogether. It doesn't right, exist in your definition, your belief.
Right, precisely. Yeah. But, you know, once we've got a language for things like, you know, attention deficit disorder or again, hipsters or whatever, suddenly there's a category and we can put things in that category and we can make sense of the world in a new way. And I think that we're suffering from a real deficit of a category called wrongness, and so we don't put things in that category, and we don't look at it, and we don't think about it, we don't isolate it as a phenomenon, and we don't talk about it. And I do think that is changeable.
On the other hand, I must bring out the timeout sheets in hospitals, which you bring up in the book, the idea of having this checklist where medical teams can consult and note, they check things off, but even despite the fact that they've accounted for every conceivable circumstance or variable, there's always going to be one that's missing. They're always going to be wrong in some sense. And as you point out, somewhere between 44,000 and 98,000 patients die each year in America based off of a medical error. Hospitals, of course, are understandably reluctant to embrace wrongness. Hey, we screwed up. Your family member died. Your friend died. So if the idea of embracing wrongness or being unresistant to change is the necessary evolution for humanity, well, then we circle back to emotional reaction. We circle back for being sensitive in light of the fact, in light of human error. There are grave costs to embracing human wrong.
I would disagree with that, actually. I would suggest that there are grave costs to failing to embrace it. Mm-hmm. That medical error has happened, and the question after it happens is, do you accept it? Do you deal with it appropriately? Do you address the family appropriately? Or do you try to ignore it or deny it or pretend it didn't happen? Moreover, that medical error is much more likely to happen if you don't embrace the possibility that it will. And I talk about this in the book. I call it the paradox of error. If you want to avoid making mistakes, if you're in a situation like a hospital where the cost of making mistakes is very, very high, the only way to try to avoid mistakes is to absolutely embrace the likelihood that they're going to happen. And for that reason, I think that the notion that embracing mistakes is somehow, you know, not appropriate in contexts where the stakes are high or the costs are so tragic as it is with medical error is totally wrongheaded. Even when errors, especially when errors are really painful and really horrifying and we never want them to happen, that's exactly when we're called upon to embrace our fallibility.
On the other hand, let's say that you have a particular belief system and you were just going to keep the door closed on certain human evils. That might also be associated with this wrongness or this error. You know, if that person is going to exist within the whole of humanity, the whole, you know, and that vital piece of knowledge is going to be there, you know, that might actually, we were talking about optimism earlier, that might actually be this complete hammer upon that particular belief system, that particular ability to engage almost in that, I mean, like for the person who immediately comes to mind for some reason is like P.G. Woodhouse, who is continuing to write his novel even as the Nazis are coming to invade France, you know, and the fact that the guy was utterly clueless or utterly wrong about what was going on in World War II, I mean, if he had not had that, he would not have created all these really fun comic novels. And so, you know, what of that particular situation? I mean, if humanity as a whole embraces wrong, on an individual-to-individual level, not all everybody is going to embrace it, and I'm wondering if that's entirely helpful for everybody.
If you mean the problem that some of us are going to embrace error and some of us aren't,
yeah.
I think that's a really interesting question, and I think it's most of all an interesting political question because we see it a little bit at play in our country. There's this notion, and the actual data is a little bit mixed on this, but there's like a pop notion that people on the left are more able to admit their errors than people on the right. And again, as I say, that's not totally borne out by the data. The evidence is a little bit more mixed than that. But I think it's both fascinating and problematic. I think it's problematic in two directions. First of all, if I were strongly aligned with the conservative side of the spectrum, which I'm not, I would be very, very worried about that. I would not want to become a part of a party that is known for its inability to admit its mistakes, because whatever else you think we can see anytime there's a crisis in this country, there is a real clamor for people to take responsibility and a real anger and outrage when people are unable to. And I would not want to become known as the party that cannot say I'm wrong. That, to me, would be a very, very scary position to be in. At the same time, on the left, I think it's worrisome to imagine that you are going to be a part of a party that is capable of reevaluating your belief system and changing it and admitting to errors when you're facing down a juggernaut of people who are absolutely unable to entertain that they're wrong, because at least in the short term, there's a certain gain to be had by just, like, you know, kind of digging in on your belief system and kind of standing there like a stone wall. So I think that the problem of how to handle the fact that some of us are going to admit error and some of us are not is a real one and a fascinating one. I think ultimately in some ways it comes down to a question of your own intellectual and ethical precepts. You know, do you believe that as a matter of both how you treat the evidence and how you treat other people, it's important to entertain the possibility that you're wrong, or do you reject that belief? And that's a decision everyone has to make for themselves.
But what of cultural relativism? I mean, you have the situation with Switzerland, in which they are the last nation, very late in the game, to embrace the women's suffrage. I mean, very late, and down to the province. We can look at that situation. I mean, I'm on the left myself, but on the other hand, how does cultural relativism fit in with that ability to embrace wrong?
Mm-hmm. I think it's a really fascinating question. I was just also, as part of this series of interviews that I was talking about earlier, I was interviewing Anthony Bourdain about his relationship to wrongness. This is, of course, the author and celebrity chef and the host of the TV show No Reservations. And he was talking, I thought, very thoughtfully about the fact that when he first started traveling, he was just a very committed cultural relativist, and that still, on a sort of baseline level, he believes that none of us have all the answers, that things change so much from context to context. You cannot go barreling into some foreign place as an American thinking you know all the answers and thinking that the way that you do things is absolutely right. Not only is that obnoxious, it's a surefire way to never learn anything. On the other hand, as he pointed out, you know, let's say you hold an absolute baseline belief that racism is wrong. I hold that belief. I'm guessing you hold that belief. I'm hoping most of your listeners hold that belief. And then you get into situations in other countries and contexts and cultures where there's a certain baseline racism that is just woven into the culture around you. And then there becomes a real question of how do you navigate that? And how that's clashing with your belief system, but you're also kind of strangely a guest in an alien belief system. And I think that those are tough questions to answer. I certainly think that they call on us to have exactly the same skill set that comfort with wrongness calls on us to have, which is a capacity to tolerate doubt and to a willingness to think hard about things and a willingness to deal with complexity and nuance. We have to have those things to think about error. We have to have those things to think about cultural differences. And even if they don't bring us easy answers, they certainly help us as a procedural question along the way of trying to arrive at those.
Yeah, but with racism, I mean, C.P. Ellis, this guy in the book who you write about, is a former Klansman, then becomes this complete advocate for low-income housing and an organizer. There is that capacity for, I suppose, steering to values that we view as wrong. And it goes back to this, what we were talking about, the Jungian clash between the conscious and the subconscious. I'm not certain if being so certain about how right we are is necessarily compatible with cultural relative aspects such as Ellis that almost defeat the rule. That there is some hope to get not someone on our side necessarily, but someone within our system of beliefs, while also celebrating the diversity of beliefs, even though many of those beliefs we will personally find offensive or wrong.
Mm-hmm. I do think that, I mean, the CPL story is a really fascinating one, and for people who aren't familiar with it, this is someone who, as you said, was head of the KKK in North Carolina, had just been, you know, fiercely, fiercely racist his whole life, had raised his children to hate black people, and then in a shockingly short amount of time, I mean, literally a handful of weeks, had this set of experiences that totally turned him around, and As you said, he went on to become a labor organizer and to advocate on behalf of low-income African-American women. It's like, you'll weep. I mean, it's an incredibly touching, yeah. moving story. And to me, it's a story about a couple of things. One is, I am really fascinated by this question of what it means to be, quote, on the wrong side of history. It's part of why I tell the interesting story about Switzerland, too, which, as you say, is a country where women weren't allowed to vote until 1971, by which point, I mean, it was just like an absolute anathema in most places in the developed world. And in that case, and in the CPL's case, I was interested in examining people who are having the experience of holding a position that in mainstream culture is just absolutely and flatly been declared to be wrong. Because I think that's an interesting position to occupy and an important one to think about. I also think that, in some ways, to me, I think one of the real challenges of being... I actually kind of want to say of being a grown-up is being able to have empathy for people who disagree with you. And the more they disagree with you, the harder it is to have that kind of empathy. I mean, when someone is starting to hold beliefs that you not only think are wrong, but actually think are morally bankrupt, or harder still, are, you know, actually undercut your own identity and your own sense of who you are and what it's, you know, what it is to be a moral person in the world. It's very, very, very hard in those moments to summon any kind of empathy. And yet I think it is probably one of the most powerful moves you can make in that situation. And, you know, you asked earlier, you know, are there ways that thinking a lot about wrongness can change us, or are there ways that thinking about it has changed me? And I do think that one of the transitions that's happened in my own life is that I find that I have gone from being somewhat dismissive of, certainly, you know, very, very critical of views that are antithetical to my own, to really sincerely curious about what is motivating people who hold those views. And I think that place of curiosity and empathy, not for the views, no one has to be empathetic to the views of a Klansman, but curious and empathetic about the person behind those views is a much more productive place to start, if you can swing it. And I'm going to be the first to say it is often very, very hard.
That seems a very hopeful note to end this conversation. Catherine,
that's a good way to do it.
We've both been right and wrong, I suspect, but it's been a pleasure chatting with you.
Pleasure was mine. Thank you so much.
I've been in the right place, but it must have been the wrong time. I done said the right thing, but it must have used the wrong time.